Welcome to the Story Powers Podcast, the show about the power of stories, the people who tell them, and why you should be doing it too. I'm your host, keynote speaker and storytelling coach, Francisco Mafus. My guest today is Dan Manning. Dan is a former fighter pilot turned chief story architect at Build the Story, where he helps founders, coaches, and consultants tell real life stories. Now, apart from our love for storytelling, there's something else Dan and I have in common. His favorite clients shout obscenities at him and cry, which is pretty close to the effect that I have on most of my friends and family. So I'm sure we'll have lots to talk about. Ladies and gentlemen, Dan Manning. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. I'm really glad we get a chance to talk. Thank you.
All right. So one of the things I don't do in this show is ask people for their story and ask to take you all the way back in time. But there are particulars of your story that I'm curious about. And the first one is to do with the fact that you were in the Air Force. Now, I gave a lecture a week or two ago about data storytelling. I'm calling it a lecture because it was at an MBA. It's not a funny word for a talk. So it was about data storytelling. And one of the things I used in that lecture as a visual was a slide that got somewhat famous a few years back as perhaps the worst slide in the world from, I think it was the Pentagon. And it's one that General Stanley McChrystal shared from Afghanistan. And I think he famously said, the moment when we understand this slide, we win the war. So what I wanted to ask you was that type of thing typical of the level of presentation and communication skills that you generally found there? Or was there some inkling that some people had some idea about storytelling and some of this other fun stuff that you now talk about?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? So there's multiple parts to that answer. Like one, it is 100% true that our ability to communicate inside the Department of Defense is not the best, that the messages are obscured, that people don't necessarily get to the point, that the images that get presented are, you know, cumbersome and almost impossible for any audience to sort of figure out. But it's not because people aren't smart or aren't motivated or don't want to communicate. It's all these other like cognitive illusions that sort of cover up those things, right? There's this idea that to be professional, it's just the facts, right? And that the more facts I present, the more professional I am. But what you know and what I know and the people that I work with know are that it's not about what you say. It's about what actually gets into the mind of your audience. And that if that's your concern, then stories are the way to go. And that you can tell a story that sort of wraps those facts in a way that just goes down easy for your audience. But there are these huge like mental barriers between people at the Pentagon that are trying to brief and trying to be professional and trying to communicate and not speak in acronyms and just, you know, speak English words instead of a bunch of letters. Those cognitive illusions prevent them from being good communicators. But as soon as they walk out of that room, I mean, everyone that I've met has a great story to tell, and they'll tell those stories and they'll share them, you know, over a cup of coffee or walking down the hall or just separately in the office. And they communicate so much more effectively there than they do when they actually go up and they're standing in front of a PowerPoint presentation. So it's this weird dichotomy in the way that people act and the separation that they artificially create between themselves and effective communication.
I've found that, of course, you're right. It's 100% a cognitive illusion, this idea of being professional, of what that type of audience wants, the famous one that we hear all the time. I hear, I'm sure you hear too, which is people saying, no, they just want the facts. They just want me to get to the point. But what I also think is there is the individual cognitive illusion, but a lot of the blame needs to lie as well with the culture, because I've found and what you hear about as well is that some organizations have broken away from that type of presenting to some degree. You know, one famous example is Amazon and their narrative memos for the C-suite meetings. And I know for a fact that that's also not the case for every part of the organization, but for the C-suite, they don't allow slides in their presentations. But there is a big element of culture there. You know, if you have a boss who recognizes that a lot of these typical ways of presenting are not terribly effective and says, I don't want that, or I encourage you to do something different, I think it's more likely that people will break out of the cognitive illusion, because I think those two things playing together are the reason and not just the fact that people have this crazy idea in their heads about what works when it comes to communication.
Oh yeah, I think you're right. One of the challenges that I had in the in the Air Force, I'm working at the Pentagon. I worked at the Pentagon for a total of I think about 4 or 5 years. I was also a speechwriter for the Undersecretary of the Air Force when I was there as well. But there's also, not only is there this bias against telling stories, right, and this bias towards this idea of just presenting the facts, but there's also a bias against reading detailed memos, right, reading white papers, for instance. And part of that comes because people genuinely are not the best writers, and they're not so good about editing and really refining down, like, what is the key message I need to communicate? So in something that could be conveyed in one page, they'll send 5 pages. And now the leaders get frustrated for reading, you know, all that extra stuff that doesn't matter because people don't get to the point. But the way that they react is by saying, I need, you know, pretty much, you know, 3 bullets that tell me, you know, what I should do. If you could reduce this to a Facebook thumbs up or thumbs down, that'd be perfect. So you just sort of like keep perpetuating this poor communication. And ultimately, there's only a couple of people, even for some very big decisions, that have actually like read and thought about the decision that needs to be made. And we're really poor about communicating that in virtually every way that humans communicate.
Something that is curious to me is how, and this doesn't only apply to the Department of Defense, applies to pretty much every organization, is that there are always parts of the organization, or at least relevant people in the organization, that will be a lot better at this stuff, but that won't necessarily travel. So, for example, in the Department of Defense, I know that Kendall Haven, who was one of the first people to do any science work with storytelling, a lot of the things we know today about the impact of stories came from some of the work he did. And a lot of the work he did was for the Department of Defense, more specifically to DARPA. So they were hiring him and people like him and us to some extent to work in counter-insurrection tactics with storytelling. But then you get to other parts of the organization, and that knowledge and that acceptance of stories as a powerful tool hasn't quite gotten there. And, you know, in companies, we see this all the time as well. There's one boss or a few bosses that are great storytellers themselves. Everyone else in the organization sucks, but they think they cannot tell stories because the leadership wouldn't accept it. It's kind of maddening.
It is. And there's also, not just among the people, but also among the, like, the domain of the presentation. Like, as you mentioned, I was a fighter pilot for a big part of my career. And a big part of being a fighter pilot is telling stories. And there's stories not just because it's the thing that you do, you know, in the bar on a Friday night, but there is, like, genuine learning that happens from those stories. One of the things that we would say as I was an instructor and, you know, teaching people to fly, one of the common sayings was that you will never live long enough to make all the mistakes yourself. You have to learn from the mistakes of others. And the way that you learn from the mistakes of others is through storytelling. So when you would go into the bar on a Friday night, whether you were a drinker or a non-drinker, you were there to hear the stories from other people, from the mistakes that they had made, from maybe the few successes that they would that they would talk about when they were there. But then you incorporated that into your own learning, into your own experience, into what you were able to apply later. But then those same people would leave from that environment and go into a formal presentation and abandon all of that great communication and all those lessons that they had learned for some dry slides, some charts that nobody can read, and for print that's too small, and then believe that they've done a great job communicating.
I guess that the secret to great communication, and perhaps the secret to wisdom, is to put our lives at risk a little more often. Perhaps that our lives are too easy for the most part. We're not about to be killed if we don't learn things fast enough. And this is why some of us are getting to the second and or the second half of our lives, if not the last third of our lives, not knowing a great deal about this thing we're doing on this earth.
No, I think that's me. I think it's right, you know, to some extent, right? That you have to get beyond what like people say is right, or what people say you should be doing, or what people expect you to do. And then when you start finding yourself and you start doing the things that you want to do, or you start realizing that the most effective way to communicate is the way that your audience needs, right? That it's not about you as a communicator. It's always about your audience and about the message that you're trying to convey. And you just need to find the best, most effective way to get ideas from your brain into your audience's brain and do whatever it takes to make that happen.
So I know that a lot of the work you did before you decided to focus on storytelling was to do with how to think better. So there are a couple of concepts that I wanted you to talk about a bit that I've come across from some of your writing or some of the things I've heard you say in other podcasts. And one of them was this connection between critical thinking and cognitive load and how they interact with stories.
Yeah. So ultimately, when you go in for a presentation, generally, most of the people that I work with are driving to some decision. And even the presentations that I would make in the military, I'm trying to help lead my boss to the place where they can make some decision about something. If you're an entrepreneur, maybe you're trying to get a customer to decide to buy, or you're trying to get an investor to decide to invest. Or even if you're just trying to build your team, you're trying to get other people to buy into your vision and say, yes, I want to be a part of that and I want to join this team. But the problem is that we often use up our audience's cognitive resources before we ever get to the decision point. And there's lots of research that shows that we have this limited amount of cognitive resources that we can devote to decision making. And decision fatigue is real, right? There's several studies that show that, for instance, in like parole decisions, if you are up for a decision to be, you know, paroled or released from jail and your case is one of the last ones in the day, you're least likely to be paroled. You want to be early in the day when the decision fatigue hasn't set in. But what we do as presenters who are not considering our audience and not simplifying our message is we use up all of those resources before we ever get to the slide or to the question that says, you know, is this something that you want to do? And every time that I show a slide that has too many words or a slide that isn't clear, or I call it like a fact-a-lanche, right? It's like an avalanche of facts. Like here's fact one, fact two, fact three. It's really hard for humans to hold on to those and to put them in context and to understand what it means. And then when you get to the end, you ask for the decision and there's just no energy left. There's no way to do that. The way that stories help that out is that stories show up with context attached, right? Every story that you tell has a context that's in it, whether you're talking about the date or the setting or your feelings or the challenge, what those problems were, what that change was. You're making it relevant to your audience so that your audience is sort of inserting those pieces that you haven't provided them. They're filling in for themselves. And the way that humans evaluate stories is at the end, right, as a whole. Like, does that story make sense? Do the characters do the things that we expect them to do? Does this story mean something for me in the decision that I want to make? With facts, all along the way, every fact I'm individually assessing. That takes time. It takes attention. It takes my attention away from the speaker, so I'll miss something else that they say. Stories just make it go down easier. You can put all those facts into a story. You attach the context. And even if you just use a story to lead off your presentation, you give that full picture of what your audience needs to see, and it just makes it easier by the time they get to the decision point. They're not wrestling with, what's he saying? They're wrestling with, is this the thing I want to do?
This might be a little evil, but I've always given people the example of decision fatigue. The thing that happens to a lot of us every day when it comes to what you eat and how you spend the last few hours of your day. So the experience I've had, and I think a lot of people have had as well, is the hardest your day, the more likely that you're going to eat whatever you consider to be crap food. And you're going to watch something that is perhaps not very edifying on TV. So, you know, you're more likely to ask for a pizza and watch some brainless TV show on Netflix if you're really tired or stressed out than if you had a great day. So, in other words, you do the easy thing. Now, perhaps not the best thing. Now, I was just wondering, if you actually do that the decision you want your audience to make was the easy one, would you not be better suited loading the hell out of their cognition just so they have nothing left to decide appropriately and just go, oh, sure, I'll do this thing you want me to do?
So, I mean, so this is an interesting approach. I think we could put together a good study to figure that out. But one of the things that complicates our decision-making is that the harder a decision is, the more likely we are to stick with the status quo, the more likely we are to keep doing the thing that we've always done. So if you want your, if you wanted to lead someone to the decision to just keep doing what we've always done, then your strategy would be, I think, very powerful and very, very effective. But most of the people that I work with, and I would bet probably most of the people that you work with, are people who are trying to create change, right? They're trying to move to something different. And that is, there's all sorts of cognitive biases attached to changing anything. And I need my audience to be fresh and ready to at least consider that decision by the time they get there. Otherwise, like you said, it's like going to the grocery store when you're hungry. When I go to the grocery store hungry, I buy all kinds of crap because I need instant satisfaction. I need to delay that and make sure I've had a sandwich or something before I go there.
The other idea I wanted to hear a bit more about is something, I think what you actually said was, big ideas poison your brain, but stories are the antidote. I'm pretty sure I understand what you mean by that. Can you elaborate on it, please?
Yeah, so as you try to convey bigger and bigger ideas, they become more and more complex for the audience that you are trying to persuade, or you're trying to get your idea into their brain. So it's that same sort of like buildup of not just decision fatigue, but also just cognitive fatigue, right? People get more and more tired the bigger the idea is. And as you give them big ideas, if you are engaged with your audience, they're trying to imagine that future, right? They're trying to imagine what life would be like in this new world that you're talking about creating, especially if you're creating a world that's maybe two steps ahead. Like one step ahead, they can sort of understand, like, here's what the world is today, and here's what he's talking about. But two steps ahead, they have to sort of remove themselves from what they know now and start thinking about something else. But stories are the antidote because they give that context to help move the person to that place. And a good storyteller is going to make sure that the examples that they use are relevant to the audience. So the audience can see themselves in the story. They can see their own challenges, and they can see how it changes. One of the ways that I talk about stories is that I've got two dogs, and if I need to give them medicine, sometimes I'll try to hide their medicine maybe in a rolled up piece of bread, or put some peanut butter or something around it, and they eat the bread, they eat the peanut butter, and they get the medicine along the way. And stories are sort of the same thing, that you are able to get facts included and sort of wrapped in a story, and you get them into your audience's brain without them realizing that's what you're doing. But when it comes time for them to use those facts, they're there and they're accessible to them so they can make a good decision.
You are the second person that I've had on this podcast that has used the peanut butter for medication trick example.
Okay. Yes,
Richard Mulholland was the other one. Now, I've had a dog, but to be fair, peanut butter is not very popular in Brazil. So I think we use that trick with different types of food. But yeah, it's curious. That seems to be the con food of choice for fooling dogs about their medication. So I've been mostly agreeing with most of the stuff you're saying. Now, let me potentially disagree with something that I've also heard you say. And it's to do with this concept of, I think you called it dopamine pumps. So it was this idea that if you want the stories to trigger dopamine, which has to do with excitement or with tension, both depending on what type of story you're telling, you want to trick the brain into going for that. And I think the lines you used are things like, but nothing I tried worked until, or I'll never forget what I saw, but then something changed. And I'm not disagreeing with that. I think it definitely works. But at the same time, I find myself very rarely using those things because I tend to tell stories in the present tense. And you can do that, but you're twisting the tense of the story a little bit too much if you're trying to do that, because in theory, you're telling it as it's happening. And if you're trying to foreshadow, and it becomes trickier. And my concern with things like that, for a lot of people, is that one thing I don't think they should ever do, which is use the word story before, like this is a story about, which I'm very much against. And the other thing is, I think sometimes this is a hack to make the story exciting or to keep the story engaging, whereas if they've put the things that are supposed to be in the right place, they wouldn't need to hack it that way. Now, why am I potentially wrong?
So I think we're all always potentially wrong, right? So what I think about is, one, when I tell stories and I'm in the middle of the story itself, I'm usually speaking in present tense as well. It just brings your audience into that place and it's more vivid for them. But sometimes I'll do something different. Sometimes I'll talk about myself and I'll be a little bit more introspective. I'll tell you what some things that you can't see. I'll tell you some feelings that I might have that you might not be able to observe. And when I do that, if I've built the trust with my audience that I'm going to take care of them, I'm going to deliver them a lesson that is useful for them, they'll follow along with that. So when I talk about the dopamine pumps, it's these things that are the little attractors that bring the attention back, right? Dopamine, we usually associate it with the good feeling at the end, but dopamine itself is a seeking chemical. Dopamine is what drives us when we're hungry to get up and go find food, right? To get out of our camp and to go on the hunt, right? To go to the grocery store, to do something else. And the more dopamine that you have, the more aggressively you're seeking the end that will allow that dopamine to be released. We get the pleasure from the dopamine being released, but only if that dopamine has built up to this, you know, pleasurable point. And when I talk about the dopamine pumps, I'm adding to that dopamine in the story so that I can get the payoff at the end. And it's never about tricking my audience, because if I trick my audience, or if I don't deliver, or if you see online all the time, it's like, you know, here's one weird trick to do this thing, or here's, you know, seven facts that you've never heard of, and number six will surprise you. And after you get to number six a few times and like it doesn't surprise me at all, I stop paying attention to that at all, because I learned that it's not worth the seeking for the payoff. But where the dopamine pumps work is when I'm able to continue building that trust with my audience that I've got you. I'm going to take you somewhere that you want to be. And if you stick with me, I'm going to make sure that I amp up that dopamine along the way, also by constructing a great story that's delivered in the way that the human brain is ready to receive. And I'll just make the payoff even better by keeping that dopamine flowing. And now I can use my audience's dopamine to pull them through the story. I don't have to fight for their attention or even fight so much for their interest, because their own dopamine is pulling them through because they want to find out what happens.
So from taste, I've tended to do more than use lines that foreshadow or perhaps hint at a twist or a payoff of some kind. So two things. The first one is, what I've noticed is that if the problem is not clearly important enough to the characters early on in the story, so if the stakes are not high enough and relatable, then the attention is just not going to be there. So what I've tended to find that with a lot of stories, what benefits a lot of stories is one line or two that explains why the problem really matters. So the example I've given loads of times is someone talking about struggling to finish a marathon. And I heard the story once at the MBA I teach, and I said, okay, so why should I care? Right? Why should I care that you can't finish this marathon? And it's like, oh, because I've trained so hard, because it's so difficult. It's like, but I don't care. Like, what does it matter if you don't finish? It's just a marathon, right? It's not. And it wasn't really the reality of this person. But I said, listen, if you're going to tell me that you used to be really big into sports, it was a big part of your identity, and then you got long COVID, and you could barely get out of the house for 6 months, and now you finally started feeling better, you started training, and you completing this marathon is evidence to yourself that you're not broken, then now I have something to care about, right? Now it matters to me. If otherwise, it's just, you know, sucks not to finish a marathon that you trained for. What I try in most of my stories is to just have that as short as I can, right at the beginning, so people can relate to it and want to see the problem resolved, even if they don't necessarily expect or know that there's going to be some bigger learning or message at the end. So that seems to be the approach I take when I either tell a story or help someone tell a story. I'll tell you the second one, but if you have anything to add to that one,
yeah,
disagree.
Yeah, so no, I don't disagree at all. I try to take that one more step. People all the time say that we have shorter attention spans than before, but then the same people will go and they'll watch 8 hours of Netflix. I say that it's not that our attention spans are shorter, it's that we have a lower tolerance for things that aren't interesting to us. And nothing is more interesting to us than ourselves. So if I were working with a person who wants to tell some story about a marathon and about how they thought about quitting on mile 20 or something, I would want to expand that story to some more universal lesson, something that would resonate with virtually all humans, unless they're speaking to a conference of just marathon runners, right? Then that might be something that's interesting to them how to finish. But for instance, the problem that I would hint at is using the marathon as a metaphor for doing hard things, or about not giving up in life, or about, the work is worth the payoff, or maybe even a story about how sometimes you work hard, but quitting is the right thing to do. And try to expand this to this broader lesson that anyone listening to the story, whether they run marathons or they run a business or they run a home or they run a family, can see themselves and are looking for this lesson about whether they are going to give up or whether they're going to keep doing this hard thing. And if I do that right, again, it's their dopamine, because they're seeking this answer, this thing that will help them to understand themselves better and to contextualize their own life better inside the story. And if you do that right, people cannot turn away. They have to know how that story ends.
Yeah. So I've often said that good story has a relatable character with a problem they care about. So to me, what you said is all in the relatable character piece, and characters are sometimes relatable by who they are, but more often they're relatable by what they feel. Because you can't, if you're not writing fiction, you can't change the details of who you are or who the character is to fit your audience. That's not going to work. But if the feeling that character has is relatable, then you can reach a broader audience, even if the details of the story are irrelevant. So I don't run marathons. I couldn't care less about marathons, but I have tried things in my life that were hard, or I have struggle to do something that I used to be able to do, or I had challenges that came up in my life that affected my sense of identity. So to me, that those are the things that will make the story relatable more than necessarily the environment or the specific demographic of the character or anything like that. And the other thing that I found that sometimes is the problem, because I think I remember I read you talking about this in the context of you had done a story for a client, and as they were reading it back to you, you found it wasn't as exciting as you thought it was originally. And one of the things I've learned was this, the South Park's end button, therefore, which you might have heard from them, you might have heard from Randy Olson, who has the ABT storytelling technique, or Matthew Dix, who has the button therefore, which is the same thing. And for anyone who's not hearing that, is that sometimes the mistake we make when we tell a story is we have too many ends. I did this, and I did something else, and you're eventually going to get to the problem, the but, and the conclusion, which is the therefore, but you have too many ends before that point, or the problem arrives, and then it's and. And their approach is add buts, or replace ands for buts. So keep finding ways to complicate the story, even in small ways, or to change direction. And that often is what brings the attention back into it. So I don't believe I'm telling you anything you don't know, but that's just what I normally do instead of necessarily using dopamine pumps of the type you describe.
But what you're doing actually is also pumping up the dopamine, right? That you're creating this complexity, right? There's a story that I often tell when I kick off a storytelling workshop about how I learned the power of story, or the first time that I really understood the power of story, I was doing about 350 miles an hour in a dive and encased in ice. And then I start telling the story about how I learned about storytelling. But clearly, I somehow survived that. Right, I went from that position to talking to you today. So there's this gap that exists inside there. And the more that I can complicate the path from that initial situation to where I am now, the harder it is, or the harder you want to work to figure it out. because you're hoping that that payoff is going to be there. So you're doing the same, you know, the same thing along the way.
Yes, I think I'm choosing to do it by, in a sense, I'm trying to do it without delivering any knowledge to the audience that I wouldn't know at the time. So the what I'm trying to do when I tell the story in the present tense is I don't know anything as the story progresses that I didn't know at the time. So I don't know that I'm going to learn a big lesson. I don't know that this is going to be the hardest night of my life. So I'm just trying to stay in the present of the story. But having said all of that, one technique that I've seen done before, I sometimes do it. I've seen lots of people recommend this, and I've recommended this in some cases, is the teasing the point of a story before you tell it as a way to lead into the story. So I think I've seen a line you used at some point. It was something like, this thing that happened with my neighbor will change how you think about suffering from food insecurity. And then you can just tell the story and you probably don't have to say anything at the end because the point is, they know what the point is going to be. They just don't know how you're going to arrive at that point. So I think that works well. I think it's just a preference that I tend to try to be as little out of the story, or, you know, have knowledge that is out of the story as possible. And some people like it. Some people like to break out of the story and like talk to the audience about something. I prefer in general not to, but I think they're just different styles of doing pretty much the same thing. Okay, so something else I wanted to talk to you about is to do with the process you go through, because a lot of the work you do now is this thing where you spend an hour with a person and you get their story out of them and you tell it back to them. And you're always aiming for a 3-minute story, which I agree, stories should be 3 minutes or less, because that's a perfect length to do a lot, to get a lot done without getting carried away and boring people to death. So I've seen you talk about the types of questions you ask, and, you know, things like what action do you want the audience to take, or what feeling do you want to engender, stuff like that. But what I haven't found anywhere are the types of questions you ask that are beyond aiming the story. So those are all sorts of things like, okay, what's our objective? What are we trying to do with the story? Great. Okay, so the problem of your customers is that whatever. Okay, once we know that, what types of questions do you ask to get the story out of them?
Yeah, so I'll tell you, like, this is something that I think about a lot, because I have my storytelling course that I'm doing as well, and I think this is something, you know, a skill that I would like to be able to convey to other people, but I'm having a hard time like describing sort of the step-by-step of how to do it. When I talk about finding the story, I've started to talk more about it. Like I'm hunting, right? You're on a hunt for this creature, and you know often like where these creatures hide, and you know sort of the behaviors of these creatures lots of times, but you don't know exactly. Like you don't know this one. So this one may have some special characteristics, and you got to look for it, and you got to look in places that maybe you haven't looked before. So I ask those initial questions for a couple of reasons. One, like I want to know, like, what are we trying to do so that I can frame that. But two, I start getting the person I'm interviewing in this habit of answering questions, you know, with me and trusting that we're going to get to someplace good. When I start asking the question about, like, what do you want your audience to feel at the end? I want them to start thinking not just in terms of facts, but also in terms of feeling. So I'm sort of priming their brain to get to that place, but I'm listening closely because their answers are going to be the things that helped me to find where that story is hiding. So after those first few questions, the next set are probably going to be more about, like, who are we talking to? Who is your audience? Who are you trying to sell to? What types of investors are you looking for? Because we need to find those challenges, just like we've been talking about, that are relevant to that audience. So I've got to understand what's the shape of the story that I'm trying to find, right? And I do that. But then the rest is listening intently. It's listening to people, because what I found is that, you know, doing, you know, lots of these, that people will give you this peek. They'll sort of lift up themselves just a little bit and show you what they really want to say, but they're not sure that it's safe to say that. They're not sure that this is an acceptable thing, or they're not sure that they want that to be a part of the story that they tell. And I always tell them, you'll get the final cut on the story. Like, you're the one telling it, so you get to decide what you're going to say, but help me to understand the context. Like, why was that scary to you? Why was that something that was terrifying? Or, you know, some people might say, you know, this thing, but you said it a different way. Or I'll say, you know, three times in this conversation, you've brought up something about your family growing up and about how it influenced your decision. Like, what do you have in mind there? What is the thing that you're talking about? I mean, the magic happens when you create a connection, or you show them the connection rather, that has existed in their life all along, but they never put those things together. And then in the process of building the story, you show them that that connection is there. It is incredibly powerful. And that is actually the reactions that you see in the little video, and people who shout obscenities at me, is that they finally see that that's the place that those things go together. And they've been trying for years to say that. And in talking to me for just a little while, I was able to put into words something that they felt for so long and haven't been able to communicate.
Yeah, so it's a tricky one, this, you know. So, you know, what is the set of questions that finds us the perfect story for everything? Because, you know, these are variable stories, right? So the way I tend to think of it is, so it's a set of things, right? I've often used the Spider-Man story, you know, the Spider-Man's origin story. And to my mind, there are two major elements of that story. People tend to think of superhero origin stories as where they got their powers, and that's kind of important. But the most important thing tends to be where they got their purpose, okay? And that will almost always be connected to some type of pain. So when I'm trying to come up with something for someone that is kind of an origin story, what I tend to look for is, okay, so there is a pain you're trying to solve in the world. When did you feel that pain first? Or when did you feel that pain last? Because sometimes the last one is the one that pushed you to action, right? So maybe it's something you've been suffering since you were a kid. You've noticed this thing in the world and it bothered you. Maybe something you suffered, maybe something your parents suffered, that friend in school, but maybe you never did anything about it until a day where something pushed you over the edge, and this is now why you're doing this thing you're doing. So it can come back to the, you know, first, last, worst, best thing that I use for finding stories. So when was the first time you felt this pain, or the last time? So sometimes it's to do with the power. Right. What makes you the person to help anyone with this? And it might be what, you know, how did you become able to help someone? But the purpose goes with the pain to a great extent. So I think to me, those are the ones that I find more often tend to uncover the type of story. But you're right. I think it's weird what ends up being sort of the best story. And I think for a lot of people, there are probably 5 or 6 episodes in their life that you could use to tell the exact same story. Sometimes it's just the first one that surfaces when you're having these conversations, and not necessarily the perfect one. So the other thing I wanted to ask you about that is something that's perhaps better illustrated by a strange case study that you and I have that I didn't know we had until yesterday. And the case study is Nosheen Aichen. Right, so you worked with Nosheen last year.
Yeah.
Not too long after I had her on the first episode of what I call the Story Powers Lab, right, where we were trying to find a story to fix a specific problem that she had. So the work you did with her yielded a more origin story type of thing. And she posted that and it went bananas. I think she called it mini viral. So it just was 60,000 plus views or something, which I don't know if it's an official definition, but for our purposes, it's worth it. Whereas what I did was very different. What I did is we were talking about how she presents herself to clients or potential clients in a way that shows, one, her expertise, but also that connects her to their problem. And we ended up with a completely different story that hadn't come up, at least hadn't come up in the final story she put out from the work she did with you. I don't know if it came out in the interview, the whole Tenerife thing and being in a cinema festival there or whatever. I realized that we might have had completely different briefs. So I'm not necessarily trying to compare the work we've done in that way. But my question was, is it more common that what you end up with is a origin story, more like an outline or overview of their journey? Or do you sometimes find that you end up with something like what I ended up with her, and which is what I ended up with a lot of my clients, which is a moment that serves as an example for a lot of the other things we are trying to talk about.
Yeah. So a couple of things. Like one, when I'm doing an interview with a story, like my goal is to get to the place where what would this person write if they had the time to dedicate to it and the skill that I have in storytelling, so that I try to not replace, you know, myself into the story that they are sharing. It's very much a skill as a speechwriter, trying to write in someone else's voice and trying to be faithful to that. So I am cautious about the questions that I ask, because I don't want to inadvertently, you know, steer them a direction that I think might be the story. I've got to be really attentive to what the actual story is that they are giving. So like with Nosheen, when we first started working together, she had shared actually the same story that we wrote. She did a video clip of it it was one of her earlier video clips, not the fantastic ones that she's doing right now. But I'm like, you know, that is a great story, but I think it could be told better. I think she could get more impact with that story. So the brief was, let's see if we can tell that story in a more effective way to get to that end. So when I'm working with a client to do that, we're definitely trying to find that one example, right? That one moment of change that demonstrates that thing, right? That where the story, like, literally, you know, pivots. It's the point of the story where things go from the way they used to be to where they are now. And in fact, in the interviews that I do, I'll spend 45 minutes just trying to find that right moment of change, because the entire story depends on that place. So it's very much about finding the example, but I want to find the example and then give the story back to them as the story that they would tell if they had the time and the skill that I have.
Yeah, I think Nosheen is a particularly difficult candidate for that, because she has like 15 moments of change, or there's so many instances of the problem that she talks about in her personal story, which is essentially that she never did the thing that she was meant to be doing. There should have been one point of inflection. There's like seven, and most of them she didn't actually do the thing that she was meant to be doing. She had opportunities to take a different road and didn't, which I remember when we were talking about it, it was also that seemed to me kind of a dead end for trying to tell a story in like a minute or a minute and a half, which is what we were trying to do, because to my mind, it would be a montage of a whole bunch of things, and it wouldn't work as much as a story if we were trying to keep it that short. At least that was the feeling I had. Because the challenge I have sometimes is that when people tell what's more like an origin story, what I've seen a lot is it ends up being a lot more telling than showing, because it's not a moment in time with some leading up to it and some resolution. A lot of people, and I'm not saying that's what you do, but I've seen a lot of times in origin stories is people want to cover a very long period of their lives and ends up being exposition, pretty much, which I think it works well on LinkedIn. I don't think it actually works particularly well if you're trying to do that live. Like you're on a podcast, you're in a talk, it just becomes kind of repetitive because it's not immersive enough, it's not engaging enough, it's not enough to get the brain going. So that's why I was wondering if the way hers turned out was an element of, and again, worked perfectly for LinkedIn, but is that, do you find that that's more like, that's an example, or is that exception that kind of proves the rule of what you're normally trying to do?
No, I think it very much lines up with what I'm trying to do. Like the one thing that I'll tell my clients is that the story is not what happened, it's how what happened changed you. So we'll have to, sometimes we'll cut out, you know, major segments of their life. It's something that's, and I'll tell them, like, I know this is something that's important to you, and it's something that in your overall, you know, scheme of your life, it's something that was, that did change and did shape who you are, but it doesn't serve this story. It doesn't serve this point that we're trying to make. It doesn't drive our audience to that action or to that feeling that we identified right in the very beginning. So what I'll do is work with them to find that moment of change that serves the story. It's not the only moment of change in their life, right? It may not even be the only moment of change in that series of events that led up to that decision that they ultimately made. But like one of the questions that I would have asked Nosheen is, so you thought about quitting your job for months prior to this. Like, why was that day different? Why was that the day that you walked in and you said, I'm not going to play around with this anymore. Like, I'm done. And then that sets off this whole series of you know, multiple other changes that she makes in her life from that. But what I want to find is that day. And Matthew Dix, in his book Storyworthy, he talks about the 5-second moment of change. And it's really hard sometimes for people to find that 5 seconds. So we'll find like a representative, you know, 5 seconds, if they, especially if it's things that happened a long time ago. But the tighter we can get on that moment, the more powerful the story is going to be.
Yeah, I find that sometimes people forget that when you're telling a story, it's not a journalistic recounting of events. Now, does that matter if it was the exact moment where you made the decision, or was one of many moments that made part of it? Like, as long as you're representing the truth of the story, I mean, does it matter if it was that week or the week after? Those things don't really matter as long as you're not fabricating stuff just for the convenience of the story. And I think that as long as you're using the story as an example of real life, it doesn't need to be actually exactly what happened that you would be able to find out only with a time machine, because our memory doesn't work that way. So it's not, oh no, I'm just going to pretend it happened that way because it works for the story. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is you don't actually remember. Like, unless you recorded it somehow, you don't actually remember that it was right after that conversation with your partner. It's like, and if you speak to the partner, it's like, no, that was 6 months before you actually quit the job, and you remembered it differently. So, you know, I think there's only so much we can try and find the absolute truth of those things. And one challenge I love taking on when we're cutting out large sections of people's lives is, what is the line or the few words that we can add to the story that pack in a lifetime of explanation? There was one story I tell in most of my keynotes and workshops, which is the one about my kid, and when I kind of completely lost my mind and like screamed at her from the top of my lungs. And the word that does that for me is again. So she was about to hurt her baby sister again. And I did what I always did. So again and always are all the context that story needs, without me saying, my kid was having a lot of trouble with her baby sister, blah, 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 blah. And I find that it's great when you manage to do that with someone else's story. And it's like, oh, but there's all this stuff. No, that's fine. We just...
I mean, what I say is that I tell my clients, like, your story doesn't have to be 100% true, but it has to be unfailingly honest, right? So we will adjust the story to serve our audience. We'll compress timelines. We will maybe even provide some dialogue that you know wasn't the exact dialogue, but it has to be honest to your experience. So you're not going to completely make up something that's different, that changes sort of the point of the story or what happens or puts you in some different light. We're going to be honest about that, but it's always going to be in service to the audience, even if we don't have the ability to make it, you know, 100% true, because we're not replaying, you know, a 30-year movie of everything that happened in my life. We're just talking about, you know, this important event that happened there.
Yes. And I think that even if we could replay what happened, for anyone that has ever watched a family video of someone's holiday, it doesn't matter how exciting that holiday was. No video of that is ever going to be exciting unless you somehow caught on camera the exact moment that a shark jumped out of the water and almost ate you. Because those things, there's just too much in them. And we don't want that. That's not what we want to. We don't want to bore people with the story just because the story is trying to encompass too many things. Right. So the last question I have for you is something very, very specific and tactical, because I know you work a lot with founders. And I saw briefly some of the types of stories that you say you help people put together when they are founders. And there was one that was not immediately obvious to me what the difference was. So I know what the founder origin story is, or the origin story, or the founder story, or whatever you want to call that. But it wasn't immediately obvious to me the difference between that and what you called, I believe, a venture origin story. Could you clarify those for me, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So we all know the stats that 90% of all startups fail, but 90% of all startup founders don't, right? Startup founders will start something, they'll try it, it's likely going to fail, and then they decide to do something else. And maybe they go take another job, maybe they work for a different startup, maybe they immediately pivot to some other idea, and they build another venture. So usually the founder origin story is something about what took them away from a relatively, you know, safe and secure corporate job to this life of entrepreneurship, which is much more uncertain, which is much higher risk, but usually it's the thing that more closely aligns with their own personal values or the things that they believe. And they'll try something and maybe it works or maybe it doesn't. The venture origin story instead, particularly if you're trying to pitch to investors, is like, why am I the person doing this business? Why is this the business that I'm involved in now? And the difference is that it is in the founder origin story, you're talking about the person, right? And in the venture origin story, you're talking about how that person and this venture intersect to create this business. So it's really for a different purpose, and it just has a slightly different focus than just on the founder and why they began to a career in entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I think the what you describe as the venture origin story is probably more akin to what a lot of people think of as the founder story. So if for example, I think about Sarah Blakely's story starting Spanx, in the beginning of the story, this is just a woman who couldn't wear the white pants she wanted for a party and then came up with a product. And then throughout that story there, you know, you can see how she has initiative, she's tenacious, she's creative. And then so you can see a whole bunch of positive traits of her as a founder through that story. But it's a story it's all about this particular product. In the story doesn't exist, at least it didn't at the time, outside of that product. And I think it's very similar to, say, the Airbnb story. If it's clearly connected to making that one venture work, whereas then the founder story, in your definition, might be about something that is completely disconnected to the product itself, but it's trying to, I guess, show that founder in a positive light as someone who will be believable when you have to eventually pivot because this thing didn't go anywhere.
Well, I mean, so the founder origin story is probably going to end up being connected to the venture that they're currently working in as well, right? But also the founder origin story is designed to build trust and to let the people that they are speaking to, often investors or maybe early customers, understand that, you know, here is my level of commitment to this thing. I'm the type of person that you can trust. I have the knowledge, skills, and experience to do this thing. And if you count on me, I'm going to come through for you. Separately, the product is something else that we may have to tell a story about how I connect to that and how I connect to the thing, right? All the examples that you mentioned are all multi-billion-dollar companies, right? They're all the companies that made it. And so far, I've only worked with a few companies that have really started to grow. Most of the people I'm working with are much earlier in their own stories, and they have to convey, you know, themselves and why they're a good bet, essentially, both for customers and for investors. And they aren't able to rely on the big Bs after their dollar signs yet.
I guess the challenge of telling a story like the two that I mentioned is that, although, yes, we now know that those are billion-dollar businesses, but most of their story is the very early beginnings of the business. But if the very early beginnings... So the very early beginnings happened before much in the way of outside investment came in. So there was content to talk about. So that they could talk about 5 or 6 or 7, particularly in Spanx's case, Sarah Blakely's case, she could talk about 3 or 4 different obstacles that came in her way before she got to the point of standing in front of an investor and ask for money. It's slightly different on the Airbnb case because that story was very small and then it got slightly bigger as they got some funding. Then they ran out of money and they had to do different things to get more funding. So yeah, I guess perhaps the difference would be that when you just had the idea and you're at the very early stages of having anything happen with that idea, you might just not have enough to tell much more of a story, and then you have to go back in time to other things you've done, because this one, there's only so much you can really talk about it, I guess.
Usually, though, you can lead up to like when they discovered this was a solution. Most of the founders that I work with have started businesses from some problem they solve for themselves. So if we can talk about this problem and talk about the challenges that they face and the other things that they tried, and it works out great if those other things they tried are things that people in the market today are trying and failing to have work, and then they get to that moment of change where either they figured out that this is the thing that's going to work, or they solved some problem, or they started thinking about it differently, or they made some discovery, and now because of that discovery, things are better, then the story just can flow together, even if they don't have a customer yet. They're still able to demonstrate that, yes, I understand the problem, and I'm the person who can be the pivot, right? I can be the change that makes this change in the world and creates a new world for all of us.
Fair enough. So if people want to find out more about the stuff you're doing, I know you're super active on LinkedIn. I'll post a link to your LinkedIn profile on the show notes. But where else should they go, if anywhere?
Yeah, the other place is at buildthestory.com. So on buildthestory.com, I talk about the services that I provide, and I'll be adding an additional section about the story building course that I'm doing. It's a monthly paid subscription course, and we're continuing to build it there. And I've got some great story builders who are already seeing some real changes in the way that they tell stories, and I'm excited about it.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for your time. I had a great, I appreciate the opportunity to give you a hard time about this.
Always, please. I love it.
All right, man. Thank you very much. This was great.
Thanks for having me.
All right, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. Take care of yourselves. And until next time. I hope you enjoyed the show. And if you did, I'd love for you to subscribe and leave us a review or a rating on the Apple Podcasts app. It's very easy. You open the app and find this show. Then scroll down a little, and when you see the stars, tap. I'd really appreciate it, and it does help other people find us. And if you'd like to get in touch or find out more about what I do, reach out to me on LinkedIn or visit my website, storypowers.com.